everybody, and welcome into the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Let me tell you something, folks. I am excited about our guest today. We're going to jump right into it today. The book I read this weekend was absolutely astounding, entertaining, and will teach you some life lessons. I'll tell you that much. If you haven't gotten around in life, you will when you read this book. The book we're talking about today is The Last Jewish Gangster, The Early Years. And believe it or not, it is only book one of three. And once you get through the first one, you're going to want to dive into the other two. Although we'll find out from our guest, David Larson, when those other two will be available. David Larson's an award-winning Fortune 500 marketing executive, has written West, Journey Across the Plains, Mr. Meeks, a prequel sequel to West. The book we're talking about today, The Last Jewish Gangster, The Early Years, Mayday, a collection of short stories, a Silken Thread screenplay adaptation with Debbie Allen, Savage Reprisal, screenplay adaptation, Pit Stop, which is a screenplay, ghostwritten a historical fiction fantasy, ghostwritten an autobiography of a boring man. You must have gotten a hold of someone in my family, David, that's for sure. And ghostwritten two fiction novels, one weaving two separate stories to merge and save a life while falling in love, the other a tale of a global catastrophe which sends the world into an ice age and the band of preppers bent on survival. This is all interesting stuff. Like we said, his current project includes the second tome of The Last Jewish Gangster, The Middle Years, The Last Jewish Gangster, The Final Years, which I'm looking forward to reading both, and we will have David back to talk about those books as well. Kathy Serial Killer, a fictional account of a true crime thriller, and The Lamb's Pimp, an account of Larson's teen years raised by an evangelical Holy Rollers. Let's welcome in David Larson. David, how are you?
I'm fine here in sunny San Diego.
You say that as I sit in your former hometown or home state of Minnesota on a 70-degree day. We're not quite freezing, but we have been freezing through April and May, my friend.
Oh, yeah, you betcha.
Oh, yeah, you betcha. Well, you at least remember that. Thanks for remembering that. Boy, I'll tell you, David, I had quite the interesting time this weekend with your book, going through the life of one Michael Hardy. Let's talk about Michael Hardy, shall we?
Okay.
He is one interesting cat, I'll tell you that. Give us a little background on Michael Hardy and his beginnings. Tell us a little bit about Michael Hardy, would you?
I met him in 2013. I was introduced to him by, as it turns out, his therapist. After his therapist heard me read opening paragraph slam that was being held at a local bookstore. I won first place, got to say a couple words, and this gentleman contacted me a month later through LinkedIn. Michael Hardy himself was, I interviewed him every week for 2.5 years.
Okay.
He was scary. Mm-hmm. First impressions. He was scamming me the whole time. initially promising me like, hey, I'm going to have some big bucks here available for you. Nothing. He just needed a hand up. He was looking for 20 bucks here. I told him to stop asking me if I could loan him money. I said, if I have 20 bucks, I'll just give it to you.
Yeah.
You know, he was bouncing around between effing people at Catholic Charities aren't coming through, or the Jewish Community Services aren't fixing my bathroom, and he was working everything he could along the way. This book really shows his devolution kind of into a life of crime, even though his mother rejected. He was being raised by her father and mother, his grandpa was Southern Baptist. Her mother was Ashkenazi Jew. So you had this duality in this life at home, and his grandfather kept governors on Michael, okay. Kept him kind of in line. And when he died, when Michael was 12, his mother denied him going to the funeral in South Carolina. First time Michael tried to commit suicide.
There's something interesting about Michael too. It's kind of a duality about him that really sets up things in the book for exactly what kind of rage and what kind of lovingness is in Michael that they fight each other throughout the book. And you've said something about that already, in that, you know, Daddy Roy is his name, his grandfather. The tender moments he has with him, just the hand on the shoulder from Daddy Roy versus the butting heads with Mother the entire time. The thing that interests me is he talks about the pride and the Star of David he has around his chest the entire time, but the most beautiful music he's ever heard in the world came from out of a Baptist church. And that
Southern Baptist.
Yeah, yeah. Southern Baptist church. There's these dualities back and forth and back and forth with them. And one of the things that's pointed out in the book, David, is that he's a Jew who eventually converts over to Christianity, which I find fascinating.
I made a mistake of calling him a Christian one time, and he about tore my head off.
Really?
No, he's a Jew. He believes in Christ.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And that was really, really important to him, that distinction. Yes.
So
he had to, in his later life, when he was so sick, he died on January 2nd, 2016. He was worried up to the point of death. You know, he was whether he was going to heaven or not.
Uh-huh.
And you know, Christ gave him a pathway there through forgiveness. He believed that might work.
Okay.
You know, it's like he was pulling on all the strings to hopefully he could get into a better place. Because really life on earth to him was...
I'm sorry, living life on earth was what?
Was hell. It was hell just living on earth. Just everything he was fighting. He just fought the whole time.
I'm curious if you ever found out from him where that dividing line was between, if he wasn't a Christian and believed in Christ, then... Where was the dividing line between being a Jew and being a Christian?
It was more in belief that there is Christ. Christ appeared to him in his cell in 1992 when he was in prison here in Corcoran Prison in California. Just appeared to him.
Huh.
They had conversations. He wrote 100 inspired poems, just poured out of him.
Yeah.
But he was just so proud of his Jewish heritage. That Star of David, you couldn't rip off his neck. You know, being anchored there, kind of his grandfather who converted. His grandfather converted to Judaism. And all the rest of his family was very Jewish. His uncle bailed him out and had him work in his pet store, selling a monkey.
Yeah, I read the part about selling the monkey, and I'm sorry, you're dipping out again a little bit with the microphone.
Sorry.
But the part that people will read about as far as the monkey, there's a monkey that his uncle Morty owns a pet store, eventually buys a pet store, but with that pet store, and by the way, I love monkeys. Monkeys are one of my favorite animals ever in the world. So I'm laughing hysterically as they have this one pet monkey and they keep selling this monkey to, is it five different families? And each time they keep returning the monkey because the monkey is too wild. And it turns out that Michael has to keep picking up the monkey from families. They won't even return it. They just call him to come get the monkey. And he has a problem even bringing the monkey back to the store because it's so wild. It's beating him in the head as they're trying to get it back to, he's trying to get it back to the store. But yeah, there's that wild monkey in there as well. I'm curious, David, you know, it perplexes me too, as I'm thinking of this, and I don't know why I'm stuck on this point, but please allow me to try and flesh this out. You know, he was so close with Daddy Roy, and you find this out as you read, The Last Jewish Gangster, that really Daddy Roy is part of the rage that builds inside him. The fact, as you pointed out, that he wasn't allowed by his mother to go down to North Carolina, which is where Daddy Roy's family is. And really Daddy Roy's family becomes the definition of love to Michael. Love, comfort, even security in his life is brought by that family, down in it's I believe it's High Point, North Carolina.
High Point, North Carolina. Okay. Yes.
This is everything that is safe in his world. And yet it's turned away from him, not just by his mother, but later in life, it's kind of denied to him by them, isn't it? They kind of separate themselves from him.
Yeah. He caused such pain and such almost embarrassment, but they accept him anyway. But such embarrassment because this guy's just got this thick Brooklyn accent, and he's not like the 8-year-old kid that first visited them.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very difficult for them to come to grips with some of that.
Okay.
He fought that most of his life. His last months of his life, he was hoping to, someone turned a corner too quick one time when he was going across it with a wheelchair, and they sideswiped his wheelchair. Now he called 911. They took him to the hospital. Another hustle. They didn't really hurt him. Mm-hmm. He almost fell out of it. He ended up getting a $5,000 settlement. He was going to buy a used Winnebago. His last wish in life was to travel across the U.S. and go to High Point, North Carolina.
Mm.
That was just critically important to connect somehow.
I got to ask, was there anybody left of the original family that would have remembered him there in High Point?
Maybe. He'd stayed in touch with some of the relatives that didn't know him, you know, write letters every once in a while, hear about some relatives that had passed along the way. But he had so many cousins. He went there for a Thanksgiving meal. My God, there were cousins crawling out of the woodwork. He never met backwoods folks that were just full of life, just so different than Brooklyn life, where it was very stifled. You know, this represented a place that was just, like you said, warm,
yeah,
inviting, family. Yeah.
So we turn to the other side of the coin, and opposite of High Point, North Carolina, is Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn, you've got a cast of characters that... there's some support there. There's Uncle Morty, which is mom's brother, who seems to be the anchor that keeps him from going insane. Uncle Morty is the guy who's kind of the fixer, isn't he?
Yeah, he'll do the fixing. He'll do support. He'll bring bail money. He'll get him a job working selling monkeys or selling ice cream. Mm-hmm. Ice cream truck until Michael gets in a big problem with a rival ice cream truck along the way. He'll be there. He's almost like the surrogate father. He was only 11 years older than Michael, so he was more like an older brother.
Mm-hmm.
The mother wouldn't. Michael thought the mother would give Morty money for bail and Morty money for court fines and stuff. And Michael thought it would be good, the way he get even with his money is not show up for court appearances. So, oh my God, he went through periods of life where he had dozens of outstanding warrants hanging over his head. And there was one time when they all got exonerated in one fell swoop. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, that because he had some information that, Rudy Giuliani was very interested in, as he was trying to nail some bigger fish, that some dirty cops. Yeah.
Which is
that's in the second book.
That's in the second book, which is one of the more amazing stories here. And really, Uncle Morty is what ties, and the only thing that ties Michael to his mother. And let's talk a little bit about Michael's mother, who's a real piece of work. Tell our audience, if you would, David, about Michael's mother, who she is, and how she ties into the story and really ties Michael into a life of crime that maybe he wouldn't have had ties to begin with, or maybe wouldn't have sent him into this spiral of such extreme crime.
Well, Shirley Rook, from the time she was about 15, used to go to Midnight Rose's candy store in Brooklyn, which is where all the people from Murder Incorporated got their in the back room, got their assignments from the mob to go commit murders. And she just loved hanging out with these men. She was a vivacious redhead. I've seen a couple pictures of her. Stunning. In 1943, Bugsy Siegel arranged a screen test in Hollywood for her. And she traveled out there, did her screen test, and she wanted to be a star. And the studios told her, well, Greer Garson, Lucille Ball, star Rita Hayworth, other redheads, Dorothy Parker, sorry, you're nice, you're talented, but no, thank you. Mother, to lick her wounds, went down to see her aunt in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And there she met her first cousin, Roy Hardy.
Yep.
And he's a big, strapping sailor, looked like Rory Calhoun, a star from back in the 40s and 50s. And the relationship went a little bit too far. She got pregnant. And Michael Hardy was actually born in the Naval Hospital on Coronado Island with pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And a couple months later, they go out to Brooklyn. The father forces his nephew to marry the mother. So no son of mine is going to be brought up a bastard, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that's done and his father leaves to go back to San Diego, the mother dumps Michael with her parents to raise. And that's kind of that arm's length Michael always felt from her. You know, I saw it in the way he viewed her all the time. And he would think, okay, you love them, meaning gangsters and those people she hung with, yeah. Not me. You think they're tough? Watch me. Then you'll love me. And it just made him fearless. There wasn't anything he wouldn't do. He'd walk into situations with or without a gun, and he'd just dominate.
Which, you think about it, that type of attitude is so out of control, so dangerous, so, you know, and there were situations where Michael didn't walk away unscathed. If anything, he came very, very close to getting ended. I mean, for lack of a better term, there's a scene in the book that's talked about where he takes one too many chances, and maybe chances against rivals that could have very well killed him.
There was a gang he formed, a dozen kids or so, at the high school he went to in Brooklyn, that he did out of self-preservation. And they had a huge riot, and he happened to bring a 9mm Roscoe and tucked into the back of his pants. And when the riot started getting too close, bats were being slung and everything, he took out his gun, started firing, shooting people in the legs. And that was one instance, and they managed to get away. You know, these days it would have all been, someone would have captured it on the cell phone. He'd been
right. Yeah.
Yeah. He'd been up the river. There was a time when, Gotti brothers.
Let's stop on that incident for a second. With the numbers in that alone, just to kind of give our audience an idea, you're talking maybe 12 members of this gang at most on Michael's side versus upwards of 50 to 100 of their gang members on the other side in this high school. And we're not talking the days of, you know, like now where every kid's carrying something dangerous like a knife or a gun. We're talking bats and pipes and, you know, and zip guns, which, you know, are just basically slingshots with metal objects that, you know, can pierce your skin, but they're not necessarily going to kill you. They're going to open up a wound that'll hurt a little bit, but and draw some blood, but it won't necessarily kill you unless it's in a strategic spot. But it's at that point in that school that Michael decides that he's going to make a statement and pulls out this gun and charges a huge, huge group of people and decides he's going to start taking out kneecaps, not kill people, but he's taking out kneecaps. And at that point, he makes a decision that he's going to make a statement, but he also realizes in a young mind that when he makes this statement, he's not going to go back to that school.
Yeah, there's no turning back at all. After that incident, they meet at the pizza place. His gang does, and they're all just hyped up beyond belief. They got bruises and some are bleeding and stuff because they were chains as well. And they use trash can lids like gladiators as shields to try and block things that were coming at them, this big crowd. He left them afterwards and said, "Hey, I've gone the way of the gun. There's no turning back. You know, you guys, good luck. Good luck." And then he had to bolt back to Florida, where his Uncle Morty lived.
Yeah.
Try and cool down for a while.
That's not only a huge decision, but that's a pretty, I don't want to use the word wise, because wise isn't necessarily, you know, one and one with a criminal mindset, but that's, what's the word I'm looking for here, David? That's a...
Impulsive?
Yeah, well, impulsive.
Rash.
It's rash, but I'm looking for like a word that I wish I had my thesaurus with me. It's kind of an out of body type of. There was like a
wisdom and a realization, yes, that hit him at once.
Yeah,
and that he couldn't hang with these guys, that they weren't ready to go that depth, that extra mile that he was ready to go. He couldn't work with them anymore.
Not only that,
he'd outgrown them.
Not only that, but it was more of a decision that says, you know what? Not only am I beyond the years of these guys are playing in a game that they're not ready for. I'm ready to go above and beyond to places that they would never go. So in other words, maybe they'll come around to my end of thinking in a few years or a decade, but these guys are playing with, you know, pipes and bats and zip guns. But hey, you know what? I got a gun and I'm willing to use it. And I'm willing to go places that they'll never go at this young age. I may be, you know, 14, 15, 16, whatever, but I'm ready to play with 25-year-olds, 26-year-olds. I'm ready to do things that are unspeakable, unmanageable, and ready to get into a life of crime. And these kids aren't. These kids are playing games.
And underneath it all, subconsciously, he's hoping his mother hears, and she thinks so highly of him. That's what she says about the mobsters that she hangs with. Oh, this guy did this. Oh, this guy. Oh my God. She tells him stories about Pittsburgh Phil that went down to do a hit down in Florida, went into a theater and took a fire axe off the wall and planted it in someone's head during a movie. Yeah. So that's a real man. So Michael's perception of what the world looked like and what she valued was so skewed.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's ready to grow up and prove himself. And really physically, he's nowhere near that. He's really nowhere near that. But he's willing to take those steps. Now, you had mentioned the other incident you were going to tell us about, which ended up physically costing quite a bit to Michael, and that had to do with I believe with a bowling alley.
Yeah. Well, they were looking for scores all the time, and they ripped off the Seaview bowling alley. He and a couple guys, Joe Fiore and another guy they were hanging with. And they caught this Tiny Little. His name was Tiny Little, the guy that walked out with the money at the end of the long weekend. And they robbed him. And they had bags over their heads and stuff and took off. And they went to a club and celebrated. And one of them celebrated and blabbed his mouth off too much. And Gene Gotti shows up. And, you know, they don't have... Gene Gotti, John wants his cut. That's what Gene was saying. He doesn't get any cut. Mm-hmm. And they went outside and they got a fight with him. Just almost, they had to bring an ambulance to haul the guy away. Well, then the Gottis came hunting for Michael and the rest of them driving around. They ended up with a huge gunfight. He took one, he was coming home, parked outside of his mother's house, and they shot through the windshield and hit him in the wrist. And he went and got that patched up. Then the very next day, they got a huge gunfight. And bullet made it through a car door into his belly. And it was really interesting because here this guy is 50 or 60 years later, after that fight with the Gaddis where he gets shot in the stomach, and he goes in and takes the bullet out with his fingers because it went through a car door. He's so proud. He shows me the wound. It's still weeping lead. Oh. 6 years later, you know, just fascinating. He had, God bless Jesse James, tattooed on his right shoulder. He had a tattoo of an eagle put on his left forearm. After he was bounced from the Army, he went to basic training thinking he'd be a paratrooper that would either kill Nazis or commies. He didn't care. He just wanted to kill. He got that in like a little badge of honor. Just trying to impress his mother, I think, make a statement all the time, just trying to get her respect and hopefully her love.
You know, what's interesting, David, is you mentioned that there's a time there that he does think that, you know, and there are times where he thinks if I go legit or do something legit that I'll be able to get her love that way. You mentioned one of those times, him enlisting. He tried to enlist first in the Navy and that didn't quite work. He tried to forge a birth certificate and that ended horribly. But eventually gets into the Army. And tell us a little bit about his trials and tribulations with getting into the Army, which wasn't exactly fortuitous for him.
Well, back in the summer, he was almost 17 years old. In August, he had heard about the Berlin Wall going up, and he was at the Mill Basin Racquet Club where his mother had a membership, and everyone was talking about, oh my God, it's going to be another war. It's Germans, it's Russians, this Berlin Wall going up. And Kennedy was president at the time, and he was all excited. And so he went back to his mother. He had tried in January to enlist, and they found their fake birth certificate. So this time, all he had to do was get his official birth certificate from Coronado, California. That came in. He enlisted, and it was like his mother gave a sigh of relief that he was out of her hair. And he was going to be a paratrooper. So he goes to basic training, and they put a couple guys in charge that didn't like a Jew boy, you know, and they just started riding him, and he rode back. And he got to the point where when he discovered that in December that there wasn't going to be any war and that Kennedy was, as he said, a pussy, then he was going to fight the Army instead. So he just started disobeying orders. He went AWOL. They threw him in the brig. And then they gave him a couple of choices. Well, you'll be in the brig for 6 months. They went to court martial. And when you get out, you'll come back and do basic again. He had no interest in doing that. So he writes a letter to JFK, tells him how he's being persecuted as a Jew. And 10 days later, some colonel shows up. You, Michael Hardy, what's your serial number? Gives him that. Okay, you want out of here? Yes, I do. Good, you'll be released. So he had both shame and pride having tried. He gets his eagle tattoo on his left forearm, like, hey, I was almost a paratrooper. No? Because the people he's going to see are going to see that and know something good happened. But it was a shame he carried with him all his life.
And it's weird. It's like throughout the book, there's these, I don't want to call them half tries, but on Michael's part, but there's these, you know, I want to get straight, but I do and I don't. You know, I a life of crime comes easy. It really does. It's one of those things where, I'm getting there and it feels kind of good to be on the straight and narrow, but then you know what? It's real easy to go back and make that easy money, that quick money, that real money to get me back where I need to be. We're gonna take a quick break here. When we come back, we're gonna talk about those little flashes on the straight and narrow. We're also gonna talk about the motivation for being on the straight and narrow. We're gonna get a little bit into Michael's personal life and why he was on the straight and narrow. The complications, we'll put it that way, of his personal life, and introduce a few more players into this and figure out why Michael couldn't remain on the straight and narrow, and the reasons for not keeping on the straight and narrow. We'll do that when we come back. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Our guest is David Larson. The name of the book is The Last Jewish Gangster. And when we come back, we're going to talk about why Michael Hardy can't keep on the straight and narrow, even though he wants to be, why he finds it so hard to stay there. We'll do that when we come back on the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is David Larson. The name of the book is The Last Jewish Gangster. And that last Jewish gangster is a man by the name of Michael Hardy. Before the break, we were teasing that it's kind of hard for Michael to stay on the straight and narrow. And he gave it a couple of good tries. Would you say that, David? There was a couple of good tries in his early years.
Yeah, he got into winning construction a couple times. And then all of a sudden, scaffolding broke and he fell down a couple floors. Didn't really hurt himself, but he was surrounded by a couple people that would told him, Michael, you're hurt. You need to go to the hospital. Wink, wink. So he followed their advice. He goes to the hospital. They're running all these tests, taking x-rays. And all of a sudden, his Uncle Morty sends someone over that's a lawyer that specializes in things. And all of a sudden, Michael Hardy is feeling a lot worse than he thought. So he goes on workers' comp. And all of a sudden, I'm not working. I get paid. So what else can I do to make more money? And isn't going to work. It's running scams, doing something that's on the verge of crime, but not yet full fledged.
Yeah.
Then he's given a job later on of working as a security guard at a clothing store, and he sees people ripping things off and nothing's being done. So he decides to take a suit. And then one night he's going through the storeroom, stock room, and he finds a box that's labeled Banlon socks, and he finds a whole bunch of cash in it. He's smart enough not to take it all. Half of it, ruffles it up to make it look like the rest of the money's there, and he splits it with the guy to get loyalty that got him the job. And out of nowhere, his buddy's getting $3,000. Michael has $3,000. Boy, back in the early 60s, that's big bucks.
Yeah, it is.
And all of a sudden there's a shift in him, and he's realizing he has this badge that he carries on as a security guy. And you can go over to the Schenectady police supply and he can buy a real police badge. He can buy some real police things. Now he has an idea of, I can pretend I'm a cop and go up and bust drug dealers. All of a sudden, he's into a different world altogether. So his straight and narrow doesn't last very long.
And he's got some motivations for let's say, leaving the straight and narrow. He doesn't have to just support himself. And this starts off a little earlier in his life. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, his mother, Shirley, says, well, you can't have kids. You're sterile. How did that story come up to begin with, David?
Oh, she told him all along that he was incapable of having kids. Michael shared this with me, that he shouldn't have kids. He's born of a weaker strain of two cousins. That there's something going on there, that she doesn't want the Hardy gene to continue. And so when he gets this young girl, pregnant. And mother tells him there's just no way it was his kid. And she almost convinces him otherwise, but he finds out eventually, almost chucks it all away to go and be with this girl, but then changes his mind. He gets busted for robbing a Greenville bar in New Jersey. And he's 19 years old. He's sent to a Bordentown reformatory that's in New Jersey, where he's set to do 2.5 years. And they allow conjugal visits. And a girl he met before then gets pregnant during that conjugal visit. And he has a son while he's in prison there. And that really causes a shift in him to watch his young boy. He gets to hold him there. And in prison, you have a lot of time to think things through. And he gets his GED while he's there. He's working on an honor farm where everything from chickens to goats to crops. And then he gets to do graves detail, which is go exhume, 5 year or older graves and have those bones crunched up and use as fertilizer. Ugh. That's when he decides not to ever eat their vegetables again.
Yeah. I don't blame him for that. That's kind of gross.
But having a kid, having a wife, a woman he married was a Natalie Wood lookalike, he said. Mm-hmm. Just beautiful brown hair, those dark eyes. And he was smitten. And when he gets out of prison, his mother's there to pick him up in a nice convertible. She drives him all the way home, just not talking about anything real. Mm-hmm. Just she's asking him to behave when they get back to her place north of New York, not in Brooklyn. He agrees to do that, but it doesn't last very long. And their relationship was so tumultuous. There was, you say oil and water doesn't even come close to expressing what their relationship is like.
So I have some questions because, okay, so Michael's got the, first of all, we kind of know it's BS that he's, by this time, that he's firing blanks because he's got the, He's got the one son with D, I believe it is, right? Which is the and then Sheila is his wife, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So and he's got not just the one, but then later on in the book we find out he's got Cheryl, his daughter, who's on the way. So obviously Michael Hardy's firing on all cylinders, so to speak. Do you feel that his mother is basically telling him this because she doesn't want to put up with another generation of Michaels?
That's a good point. I didn't think about that, but that's probably more true than anything else. He was such a thorn in her side. Just an embarrassment, almost. From the way she treated him at every turn. And when she was arrested for... he was running a finger of the... five fingers in an international car theft ring, mm-hmm. back in the early 70s. And she got pinched because he was driving cars out, brand new Cadillacs. This is really funny what the mob used to do. Mm-hmm. This is just, they would follow a guy home that had just bought a new Cadillac. And the guy pulls into his driveway out in front of his brownstone. He runs in to go see his family. Come on out, let's go for a drive. The car's gone. They take it to not a chop shop, that's something like that, a big warehouse where they have access to all the VIN numbers and the VIN plates they used to put by the windshields.
Okay.
In all these cars in a junkyard, they take an old one, slap it up there, and they'd have the Albany DMV change the registration. Then the car was clean, so to speak. Not worrying about the other VIN numbers because everybody always checks the one up by the windshield.
Right.
Then he would drive them out. There were five fingers to this international car theft ring. He was in charge of the one on the West Coast. So he'd buy the cars for $600, drive them out. His mom's deal was she was going to sell them. And she was up in La Costa. She had a place there. She was problem was she started letting these cars pile up, and it's always a little old lady, complaining to the police. There's these new cars from, they have New York plates on them. Damn it. You know, they're in my driveway. And they came out, camped out on her for a couple weeks, then approached her and arrested her. And she wanted to cut her time right away. So she gave up her son.
Oh,
that was the second time in the 3 years before that. She had him do her time in Mexican prison.
That's
so
crazy.
It's just like he never learned. But he was searching for any way that he could impress her, that she'd respect him or love him or something.
And I know you and I were talking before the show, and it just seems like, and I had pointed out that, you know, mother was the ultimate narcissist. She's just the ultimate narcissist. There's no, and I'll expound on that, that he was the whipping post, and her two daughters were almost like the show pieces. They were her pride and joy. They were the ones that she showed off. They were untouchable. They were the evil stepdaughters, if you will, in the Cinderella story. And really, Michael was Cinderella. You know?
Yep. The shoe never fit, though. Ever.
Right. Yes. The shoe never fit for Michael. It never did. And, you know, when you examine, at least in this book, when you examine and really Michael has a tough choice here, and this is where I'm bringing this around to Dee and Sheila. Michael really has this deep love of Sheila, but Sheila makes a mistake in the book that really gets at Michael. She rejects him in a way that affects him deep down, that makes him feel like he's not good enough. And it triggers something in him, doesn't it?
Yeah. When he was in prison at Bordentown Reformatory, and by the way, the name Bordentown Reformatory, I would have never met Michael Hardy. He would have been three-struck in New York years later for a crime, for another felony, had some court clerk not understood that the Bordentown Reformatory was for anyone up to the age of 21. They assumed it was for under 18. Reformatory, because had they realized that, he would have been three-struck for a crime.
Really?
That would have sent him away from prison for life.
Huh.
But while he was in prison at Bordentown Reformatory, after he got out, came home and everything, his first night with his wife, with Sheila, it was real special. His son was asleep on the bed, a little crib near them and everything. And after they finished, you know, he started questioning her. You know, this, it was okay. You know, he was in prison for 2.5 years. If you met someone, it's okay. I'll forgive you. It's all in the past, you know. And she finally broke down and told him, OMG. Oh, the rage he felt. The rage. And it changed everything in the relationship.
Yeah.
He continued on as a, but there was no forgiveness. Impossible. He stayed with her, but it gave him the excuse to start womanizing, start just using women.
Yeah.
And his biggest problem in life has to do with how he dealt with women because of his mother.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, there's a point too where he decides, well, you know, there's Dee over here. You can tell Dee looks at me and she loves me with this deep love. And she really just wants to be a family, me and the kid and her. And it's kind of encouraged by Dee's mother that, you know, you guys could be together. You could be a family. It's okay. You could just move in here. And meanwhile, you've got Sheila, who's kind of the unattainable now. You'll never truly have Sheila's full affection because you go away, she may just go with someone else. So you're always forever chasing her. So you've got two sides of the coin. You've got the one that reminds you of mother. You've got the one that, of course, is easy picking, so to speak. So at one point, he decides, I'm going to put myself right in the middle, literally, and moves out and gets an apartment right in the middle. I mean, he physically spaces himself, which I find fascinating because it just tells me that he's torn. He has this duality throughout the entire book. Am I a Jew or am I a Christian? Am I chasing someone who loves me or am I going to settle for the easy pickings? Am I going to go straight or am I going to take the easy money? And there's always a dual side to Michael. There's always, it's never, I'm taking one path and I'm going.
Yeah, he kind of goes half-hearted, sits in the middle and sees where the ebb and flow of life takes him. And the allure of easy money is what drives him most. I mean, he starts robbing banks with guys down from Boston because it's easy money. My God, they rip off one for $31,000 and he gets a quarter of that. Oh, almost $7,500. And he goes, okay, so instead of being the getaway driver, how do I get into the game? How do I get to go inside and tell everybody on the floor? He just wants to do that. And they said, well, get a gun. So he goes and buys a replica of Thompson machine gun from the Second World War. And the same company sells barrels of that gun because the replica has a fake barrel. Mm-hmm. Well, he buys a barrel separately, comes to his house, he loads it up, he goes down to the basement, he puts in that first clip, and he starts firing. And then he realizes, oh, these bullets ricochet. And he just barely misses. The bullets are flying around his head, but he knows the gun works. And then he gets to go inside the banks. Someone else drives. And that's what he wants. He just loved that, the power in commanding those people in the bank. And then he started robbing drug dealers with a number of people present even. And where he'd go in with a gun and just control the situation. You know, big crap games. He'd bust in on him. He'd get leads for stuff. He was very good at paying off his informants. There was a postman that used to inform him all the time where drug stuff was going on. There were a couple other guys that knew where big scores were going down, where money was being held, where there was a big crap game or poker game he could go rob. And he just loved that stuff. And he'd have the people strip down to their underwear. You know, he'd just take off all their money.
Mm-hmm.
It was easy money. He just had no fear, which made it very, here's a guy that's 6'1", over 250 pounds. So he's not some, you know, you think of a lot of Jews being kind of like a skinny Meyer Lansky type of person. No, he had that Southern Baptist part to his physique. Yep. And he would go in with a square jaw and just command.
You know what I'm finding out, David, as I read this book, and I think a lot of our audience will find this out too. First of all, if you've pardon my language, Michael got in a lot of shit over a small amount of time. One, he blew through a lot of money. He would talk about going to a club and tipping a waitress $100. He'd blow through a lot of money for no reason. Okay, so there's that. But then the second thing is his mind was wired not so much to be frugal, but his mind was wired for action. He was addicted to the action. Okay, so it was very much, so where's the next score coming from and what can we do next? So it wasn't so much the money, I don't think, because he would come away with a score for $1,000. That's okay. Or you would talk about boosting cars. He would boost cars for a while and they come away with $500, $700 for a night, but that's okay. We're going to go out and do it tomorrow night. It was more the thrill of the action than it was the amount that they were coming out with. It was just to get in some dirt. And to get into the thrill of it. But he kept getting into it. But what I'm finding out about all this as I'm reading it is it wasn't so much the thrill of the action as I think it was easy not only to get into, but to get away with. You read, it's the ratio. There's a ratio to this. It's the how many times do I do it versus how many times do I get caught. And the amount of times you get caught isn't proportionate to the amount of times you do it, is it?
No, I mean, he killed 19 people in his life, and he was only arrested one time. And I start the book there. I start the book with he's being arrested 5 years after his he murdered his wife. I figured if people can swallow that and understand that, then they can handle the rest of the book, because that's pretty vicious. And his son Robert helped him bury the body.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, he has got his kids involved. His son was over 20 years old at the time. His son, by the way, just got out of prison.
Really?
He was the first. Oh, yeah. He was the first prisoner that was three struck up in L.A. And it was for burglary, because they consider that a violent crime, even though no one was home at the time. And he was going to be put away forever.
Wow.
They recently changed that three because of COVID and everything else. He got out about 6 to 9 months later.
Really? Wow. So
I've had the inclination of thought of contacting him to interview him.
Okay.
I would have the son of the last Jewish gangster would be a very different story.
That would be fascinating.
I don't know if I'd want to, because there were sometimes in the early days when I started interviewing Michael, met with him every week. I felt like going home and taking a shower.
Really?
It was there was so much anger, so much disgust in what happened to him in his life and where he's ended up. Here he was in a wheelchair, 325 pounds, missing half of both his feet to diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he's in a Section 8 apartment. It's really a converted garage. He's got a wife, which surprised me.
Yeah.
That's with him at the time. And just barely making ends meet. I mean, he's pissing off local merchants. He's shut down from going to this chicken pie shop on El Cajon Boulevard because he stole salt shakers and tried to shake them down once for a chicken bone that got caught in his throat. You know, and they saw, three meal, and then how about a pie? Oh, slice it by? No, I want a whole pie. You know, it just kept on pressing the envelope every chance he could. You know, even in his later years, even with his, you know, so to speak, understanding how to forgive the Christ-like qualities you would see. Now, there's still this gangster in him that just wouldn't let go. Oh, how I got over that dirtiness feel of just taking notes and listening to his life was it's a story. If I just focus on being a story, I can disassociate the wrath that he's coming out with as he's telling his story and make it palatable for me to be able to take these notes. So I interview him 2 hours every week, put those 2 hours through my writing group, come back with them, show it to him. He wasn't good at doing color initially, because I'd want atmosphere. Tell me about the famous restaurant, what it's called in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Tell me what it's like. And it would just throw him off track in his storytelling. So I would just do my research, see what the famous restaurant looked like back in the 60s or something. And then I'd be able to write that up. Then he'd tell me what was wrong. Change. And that actually worked out pretty good between us.
Hmm.
But he spent all that time telling me what he did and finally why. And that's when the floodgates opened up as far as him being able to tell me how his mother impacted him. It was still not in my face. It was in between the lines.
And you mentioned that, and you use an interesting tool, an interesting person to bring that out in the book, and that is his lawyer, or one of his lawyers, in a case that he's being brought up on. Is his name Michael Blatt? Is that the name of the...
Jimmy
Blatt. That's okay.
Oh, he's a great guy.
Is he?
I met him. Michael, we had a chance for Michael to meet with him. In fact, Jimmy put us in touch with a Hollywood producer.
Okay.
And a real big intellectual artist management who I signed with.
Huh.
And Michael screwed up the whole deal.
No.
Michael got so impatient just Joel Gottler, which is like the uber agent that's made all great books and movies happen and everything. Everything was coming together, and he was going to be going over to London Book Fair and going to pitch this, and everyone on his team was all signed up, and I cranked out chapters of the stuff, and I gave him like 15 chapters to take with him to read on the plane. Mm-hmm. And 3 weeks later, it's taken forever, but he went there a week early, vacation time, London Book Fair. And then the week when he got back was a Jewish holiday.
Okay.
And we weren't getting answers. We were getting anxious. And the first thing we heard back was, well, I'm not used to this book. And it's not written in third person. You know, he's not used to that. So a couple of his team took a read at it, and they said, oh my God, the voice of this guy leaps off the page. All this stuff works. Okay. Hardy decided he was going to pull the big move, that he had publishers in New York ready to go on it. And we don't need you, you know? And then Joel Gottler said, okay, never mind. Goodbye.
Oh,
so he couldn't help himself. He was trying to, and he kept on thinking that just Joel Gottler's got it out for me. He wants to put me on the frying pan, make me sizzle. No, it's business to him. It's just business. They don't care about Michael Hardy. Yeah. They want to sell books and make a movie.
Yeah.
No. His wife and I begged him not to do anything, but he still put his fingers in the pot, stirred too hard.
No.
That took care of that.
Oh,
yeah. So he was real close. And he had gone through, he'd gone through another guy that was hustling, supposed to tell a story and cut a deal. Well, before he went to prison in 1990, before he got arrested, November of 1990 for murder, earlier in that year, Disney had cut a deal to take part of his life, this one incident in his life, mm-hmm. turn it into a movie. He got $150,000 for doing that.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, it had been his kids were set to go to what turned out to be McLaren Hall, is a orphanage type setup in El Monte, California. And they were at a court hearing. He'd just gotten out of prison and for something else. And the judge looked at him. He said, well, you're unfit. He looked at his mother and said, well, you're unfit. He looked at Hardy's wife. He said, oh, you're unfit. she had been a hooker and just all this crazy stuff. So he said, well, he remanded them to go to this foster care facility.
Okay.
Well, his daughter told him what was going on at the foster care facility, and Hardy followed the bus, took out a gun, crashed into the bus in the back, took out a gun, hijacked his kids, kidnapped them, and a black pregnant black girl went in their car and started taking off. They dropped off the black girl at her grandmother's. They started taking big cross country, national manhunt and everything. However, he called up a reporter at the LA Times, and he told them what was going down in McLaren Hall. And they made it all the way to Brooklyn. He even robbed a couple banks with his daughter there to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. Isn't that nice? Or things like that.
It's a nice bonding ritual.
I know, yeah. real bonding on the road. His wife ends up going crazy, calls the cops. He gets arrested, taken to Rikers Island, brought back to the LA County Jail. And the guards are treating him like gold, because by the time he gets back, this whole case with McLaren Hall is broken open. They find a big torture chamber downstairs below the orphanage, all the stuff that was going down. So he's a hero.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, really? That's probably one of the good things he did in his life, but for the wrong reasons. But they made a movie. Starring Patrick Swayze and Halle Berry,
yeah,
called Fatherhood. And Michael was supposed to be part of their promotional tour and everything for the movie. And after he got arrested for murdering his wife, and the movie's going to come out months later, they just scrap that big promotion, just released it a couple years later, real soft release, nothing happened to it. Again, just managed to screw up something.
Jeez.
Yeah, he couldn't help himself. He couldn't, you know, it's like a shark that has to keep moving or he dies.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
He just had to. Couldn't be by himself.
And it's very obvious in The Last Jewish Gangster, the early years, that he, it's exactly that. He has to keep moving. He has to keep moving or he's going to die. It's beyond me. You know, if you were to take that kind of energy and spin it positively, man, what an impact he would have made on this world. You know,
he was brilliant. He was horrible in relationships, especially with women, if you can understand.
Yeah.
Men he was very loyal with. Oh, some of his buddies from schooling, from grade school, incredibly loyal with. But women, he couldn't figure them out because he couldn't figure out his mother. And it's just the paranoia that went around with that and the distrust just ate him alive. And it just affected so much of his life.
With Jimmy Blatt, the way that you tell the story through his pen, through his tape recorder, and you draw that parallel out of him, it's brilliant. And I have to give kudos to you for that, that it draws that humanity out of him. You know, it's not just a man running wild, running free, committing crimes and going from act to act to act to act. You do actually get the rationale out of him as to why he's doing it. You do get the humanity out of him. You do find out what makes him, not only what makes him tick, but you also find out, you know, that there's a soul in this guy, a heart and soul in this guy. And there was, you know, reason for him to be hurt. And that he keeps getting hurt. And you know, you're almost rooting for him to find a reason to slow down and find a reason to, you know, get over being hurt, to heal, which I want to commend you for, David, because there's not with someone who's that destructive at times. I think in society, we see it from the outside looking in, and I think we root for that type of destructive behavior to be demolished. You know, we want to see somebody on the other side of bars at some point see the death chambers, you know, and we don't really understand what makes those type of people tick. But a lot of times we're not seeing where it's spun from or where it's created. And I think we get a little notion of that from this first book. But the fact that there's two other books is, I don't know, it's titillating, but it's also a little exhausting to think of where all this emanates from, you know?
Well, his Jimmy Blatt was, he's gone through the book, and he gave me feedback, some of the conversations they had. But Hardy, oh my God, Marcia Clark was on the prosecution team. And yes. Hardy was trying to, this is a year before OJ, and Hardy was trying to get Sheely to cut some things. And who is this Marcia anyway? What is she, on the rag or something? He would, when she would start approaching his party's biggest problem wasn't killing his wife, and what they were trying to get him for, murder in the first degree, depraved indifference. But it was how Marcia Clark was brought in specifically for domestic abuse cases. And how she was going to fry him. She wanted murder one. She wanted everything.
Yeah.
And she wasn't going to let go. And then the Marsh Goldstein, who was the prosecutor, had this crippled hand. And Hardy's going, oh, great. I got a woman on the team that wants to fry my ass. And then the jury's going to see this guy with the crippled hand. There's no chance. He's waiting for Jimmy to put in a fix.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you know the judge? Don't you know the system? You could fix things and make it all go away.
Yeah.
It was constantly he was looking for that edge or something. And Jimmy kept on saying, time is to our benefit. Just hang in there. and it was driving Hardy crazy. He started asking, he wanted him to increase the bail so he could be put on Millionaire's Row at LA County, because he didn't want to be a wayside supermax out in Van Nuys. You know, it's a grubby little prison. This LA County is better place to be. You know, he's trying to cut deals like that. I mean, he's in the middle of all this stuff, you know, even from his prison cell. But he did use the time to go to the law library. He did study stuff. I mean, he pulled some things in court that were really amazing that they could probably, like one time he went crazy, literally crazy in court. And he had a public defender. He turned to him and said, I forget what the number was. There's a
7:30, right?
Yeah, there's a 7:30. Just, hey, you whisper some. Be ready to ask for a 7:30. You know, what? Just be ready. And then he goes crazy in court, starts throwing papers around. The commies, the Nazis are coming at me. Oh my God. And his lawyer yells this out, and the judge wraps the gavel. 7:30, take him away. Well, take him away to Bellevue to have him analyzed. And Hardy's able to escape.
Man.
You know, they take him to Bellevue, they send him to the state mental prison for a while for evaluation. He finds a guy there every day is making a new key to get out of the place. It's nuts. And he manages to befriend him and escapes. You know, he's on the run. And what does he do to make money? He goes robs a couple of drug dealers to get a flight to L.A. To go where? To hang out with his mother. Of all the times when you would expect him to go in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Sometimes
he goes right back. Out there. But you know, as we talk further and further and we talk more and more, David, I think people are seeing the parallel here. And the parallel is, as he gets older, he's more and more like his mother. And the fact that you said that thing about Millionaire's Row and that he just wanted an upgrade in prison surely shows you, and I use the name Shirley and then I laugh, Shirley shows you that he's become more and more like Shirley, in that he's always looking for an upgrade. He's always looking for an angle. He's always looking for another way to get over. And that's truly what it was, even up to the end of his life. I think it was just another way to get over, which is kind of sad. And the harder he fought against her, the more he became like her.
Yeah. His sister said that. His sister, Nancy, who I just talked with last week, was just, they didn't see it in each other. They just hated each other. But they were the same. Never paid rent, always looking for an angle, just get one up on someone, just eke something out of someone, get them to give you more than they were supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything in your favor. They were just looking for that upper edge. He did it from everything from local businesses where he went to a 420 shop that sold paraphernalia and out here to, he was scamming people because he'd take a diabetes medicine and sell it black market. Like he'd get extra, you know, he tried to take his dog and who they lost AKC papers for. They made up some fake ones. He's trying to pick up some stud fees off of them. And when that wouldn't work, he just accused his dog of being a homo. You know, it's just the way he worked. It was entertaining many times.
Unbelievable. But so you even said earlier that there were times where you felt like you had to go home and take a shower after meeting the man. But now that you've had some separation, pointed out, he passed away in 2016. When you look back now, and final question here for you, David, when you look back now and you look back at the man who is Michael Hardy, what redeeming quality can you say this man had? If you had to look at him and you had to paint him in the best light you could paint him in, David, what redeeming quality would you give Michael Hardy? What did he have?
Loyalty.
Yeah.
That one word hits me more than anything else. I saw him, as misguided as it was, and even when he screwed up that first big deal we had with Intellectual Artist Management, no, he felt he pretended it was me that was being put upon. The guy wasn't coming through, but he was feeling like he was being abused. And he it was like a protective thing he was doing for me and then showing me what he could do, you know, in a convoluted way, you know, that. And then I saw every day he'd do FaceTime with his grandkids. Yeah. That were living out here. That was important to him. I have to share this with you because it was
sure.
so cool. I was in the middle of a meeting with him, and his daughter calls, mm-hmm. and his daughter Cindy's asking, "What am I going to do about my 14-year-old daughter? You know, she got pregnant by some 24-year-old Mexican. Mm. You know, and instead of Hardy saying, "Well, that's rape. Let's fry this guy," you know, he says, "Oh, she's not behaving? Oh, I'll tell you what you do. Send her into foster care."
Oh.
No, look how well we turned out.
Oh, no.
He was put into foster care. His daughter went there for a while. He didn't have any recognition of how damaging that was. It was like, it will toughen her up and she'll make better choices after that. That really surprised me. That told me a lot about him, how he was still stuck. But his heart was so warm when he talked to his grandkids on FaceTime. I'd watch him just, "How you being good boys and girls, your mommy, daddy," you know, just, he couldn't do much as a grandpa. And his son-in-law didn't want him around the kids much at all, obviously. Uh-huh. They'd have to go to a public place, you know, not knowing how he'd react. He stabbed his son-in-law a half a dozen times.
What?
Yeah. His son-in-law came after him. He drove over his place. He's so angry. I forget what it was about, but he came out to his car and jumped in his, he put his head through the car. Hardy couldn't get out. He's in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
He pulled the guy in by his shirt collar, took out a knife and started stabbing him, put him in the hospital for 6 months.
Oh,
oh yeah. Guy never squealed on him though.
Wow.
Yeah, that was later on in life.
Wow. Dangerous. Oh, yeah. Dangerous to the end, huh?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's why I was a little cautious about. One time I asked him, I made a comment, "Well, that was really your ego getting in the way." "My ego? My effing ego? You want to see an ego?" Okay. Okay.
Okay. Easy, buddy.
You know, of those stories he told me too, I looked for corroboration as much as I could because, you know, people can be long-winded, someone like that. He was just a superb storyteller.
Yeah.
He was a great storyteller. He'd fall into present tense when he'd tell a story rather than just past tense, "Well, I went here and went there." No, I go in the room, I got it done, I stick it in his face. It wasn't stuck it in his face. No, he's reliving that scene. And I tried to make that come out in the book so that's the way he talked.
Interesting. Huh. Although, you know, I mean, stereotypically, when you watch gangster films, they tend to talk in that present tense when they're reliving something. It's almost like a form of PTSD, especially when you're, you know, when you're reliving some of those more traumatic scenes, you tend to be reliving the moment if you tell it. But yeah, I believe it. Yeah. I believe a lot of times when he's telling you those stories, he's in the moment and living those moments rather than just telling you a story.
Yeah. Well, he sure had some admiration for certain people in law enforcement he dealt with though. It was fascinating that he didn't think all cops were bad, or, you know, all jailers were bad. All the screws, you know, the guards were bad or anything. No, he just kind of took, he had a black guy in his, black kid in his gang in mm-hmm. high school. Mm-hmm. He didn't make any distinction.
No.
Although he used the N-word.
Yeah.
People acted a certain way. Yeah.
Yeah. I've told this before on the show. I'll say it one more time, and that is that my grandfather, even though he was in World War II and he fought in Corregidor in the Philippines, when I was in high school, he had me help him build a Japanese waterfall in the backyard. Yeah. And when I asked him why we were doing this, he said, because I had to fight the Japanese in World War II doesn't mean I didn't respect my enemy.
Ooh. Yeah. Ooh, that's nice.
And that, yeah. And that was the exact words that came out of his mouth. Doesn't mean I didn't respect my enemy. So I have a feeling that was a lot of what was going through Michael Hardy. Just because he fought them doesn't mean he didn't respect them.
Yeah.
And there was probably some that he fought that just because he fought them didn't mean he didn't respect them. Just because they were on the other side of what he was doing or what he was trying to accomplish didn't mean he didn't respect what they did for a living. So, although there are probably some that treated him unfairly, that those were the ones he didn't respect, and he, you know, he probably do what had to be done. But there were probably some that, you know, he had to fight with that they earned his respect. So yeah, I get that mindset.
Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he was one of those.
Yep, exactly. Folks, I'm going to encourage you, go out and get that book right now. It's available on Amazon. We also have a link in the description of this program for you to go out and get that book right now, The Last Jewish Gangster, The Early Years. It's book 1 of 3. I'll tell you, David, I'm looking forward to books 2 and 3 because I got to find out what happens here with Michael Hardy. You've kind of teased us a little bit. There's the Giuliani years, which are coming. Is Nick Pileggi making an appearance in 2 and 3?
He's been a force in Michael's life. In number 3, he will.
Okay.
He actually meets him in number 3 and stays in touch with him.
Okay.
And he really helps him out when Hardy gets out of prison.
Okay.
In early 2000.
Okay.
And gives him a leg up and wants to see him do well.
Okay. So, and Nick Pileggi, of course, the man behind Wise Guy, Goodfellas, and Casino. So, we got more story, folks, that'll be out there. But pick up the first one first, The Last Jewish Gangster, The Early Years, book 1 of 3. David Larson, thank you so much for spending time with us here on True Crime Tuesday. We look forward to having you back to talk about the middle and the end years there.
It's been a hoot. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you, David. We appreciate you. All right, it's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free, and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.